Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 246. As numbers go, that's unique. 246 holds a powerful secret in the world of mathematics. It's the smallest proven limit on the size of the gaps between infinitely many pairs of prime numbers. A huge step forward solving the ancient riddle of twin primes. Mathematician Yitang Zhang made a momentous discovery in 2013. He proved that all prime number pairs that are separated by a gap of at most 70 million and at least by 2, that the gap was bounded, meaning it couldn't get infinitely large. Following this, a group of mathematicians began a race to reduce the huge 70 million number. Through incremental but brilliant work, they managed to systematically lower the guaranteed maximum gap size. The result of all this work, the best proven maximum gap size is 246. In short, the number 246 is famous in math because it is the smallest proven limit on the size of the gaps between infinitely many pairs of prime numbers. Stunning news for maths geeks. Hold the front page. But that's not all, folks. In South Africa today, the Department of Home Affairs has a form called DHA 246, which is an application for renouncing South African citizenship. There are some descendants of the Voortrekkers who've recently filled out their DHA 246s after fleeing South Africa as refugees for their beacon of political stability, the United States. More strange but true in upcoming episodes. Back to our subject today, the causes of the Anglo-Zulu War. The year 1878, and Cape Governor Sir Bartle Frere is throwing the empire's weight around South Africa. Let's put ourselves in his shoes, because some historians say he had a formidable Machiavellian personality, full of fatal overconfidence, too used to having his own way and to ignoring the magnitude of obstacles confronting him. One of those perceived obstacles was Zulu King Cetshwayo Khampande. Crowned in 1873 after the death of his father, Mpande Kazenzangakona, Cetshwayo presided over a squabbling nation. His great place, Ondini, is close to where Ulundi is today. It was vast, elliptical in shape, stretching from 560 meters in one axis to 507 meters in another. The outer circumference of his ikanda, the royal residence, was over 2 kilometers long. The second part of his great place was a smaller group of ikanda called Imangweni. The unusual point about Imangweni is that the principal hut was actually a Western-style house. The Norwegian missionaries at Empangeni had helped build this house, consisting of 3 rooms with glass windows, along with wooden doors and whitewashed walls, under a thatched roof. Cetshwayo went a step further at Ondini, where his special residence was built out of sun-dried bricks burned black. These materials were given to Cetshwayo by Norwegian Mission Society's Reverend Omund Oftebro. Omund sounds like umondi, the Zulu word for a sweet aromatic herb. This herb is used to treat flatulence, i.e. farting. So there's some irony in the fact that the Reverend Omund Oftebro's mission was called Umondi. It's on the outskirts of Ishowe. This black-bricked building at Ondini was larger than his other retreat. 4 wallpapered rooms there, glazed windows and verandas at the back and the front. It also had 2 outside doors with locks. The rooms contained European furniture, a washstand and a large mirror. King Cetshwayo would hold court in this house, tending to the affairs of state, consulting his counsellors. At night, the doors would be locked and guarded by 2 women armed with guns. Yes, folks, women armed with guns. Cetshwayo's chief gun runner and a chief himself, John Dunn, the English trader, personally trained these Zulu VIP guards in how to shoot. The bodyguards would be instructed in musketry and were armed with short carbines, ideal for close-quarter bodyguarding. Dunn took the women into the felt every day in the late afternoon, and target practice would follow, which included peppering the local aloes. This echelon of women bodyguards accompanied Cetshwayo when he visited his chiefs. The intention was to protect him when the male Amabuto were away. One of his maids-in-waiting, Nomguko Dlamini, told of her life in the ikanda in a rare book called Servant of Two Kings, by Paulina Dlamini, because she became a Christian and changed her name. The book is full of information about day-to-day life in the 1870s, how the gatekeeper at Undini woke everyone by calling out the king's praises. Bechuayo would emerge after the woman of the Isigodlo had swept the yard. Then he often went off with his sporting guns to hunt birds. Later, the king would head off to a small enclosure in the royal kraal, where he would stand on a stone and be washed with water from the Mbalani stream and then rubbed down. The young men who attended the king were trusted sons of senior chiefs of the Xolo line, as well as sons of Mnyamana of the Buthelezi. As he sat on the stone to dry, a breathless silence descended on the great place. Dlamini and the other young maids of honour would sometimes peep through the latticework walls to admire their naked king. After washing, he would eat breakfast prepared only by Mnyamana's Buthelezi clan. No sound was allowed while the king ate. Anyone breaking the rule could be killed. When he wanted to urinate, he would wander behind his hut stroke house so that no one would use any part of his body for muti. If he wanted to take a number two, he would don a large black overcoat with red trimmings, a black hat and shoes, and head off to a small hill nearby. Thus the day-to-day life of a Zulu king. Unfortunately, many in Zululand did not accept Cetshwayo's rule and began to test his strength. One of the most spectacular cases took place in 1876, when the marriage laws were broken. This was the fundamental power of a Zulu king to decide when and where men would be married. The marriage of the Ngunge, as it would become known, was a bloody affair. It happened like this. At a meeting of Amabuto warriors in 1875, Cetshwayo had granted permission for the Ndlodlo Ibuto to put on the headrings and marry. These men were already in their 40s. The Ndlodlo regiment had been formed way back in 1857, and they had been waiting patiently for their turn to take wives. The problem was, he gave them permission to seek brides from the Ngunge Ibuto, where the girls had been born only between 1850 and 1853. They were far younger than the grizzled warriors seeking their hands in marriage. Many of these young women had already formed relationships with the Mbonambi, the Mtapu, and the Ududulu men, all far younger than the Ndlondlo. At the time, it was customary for these unmarried girls and young women to have several lovers. But if you remember our earlier episodes, there was not full penetration. The practice of hlobanga meant slight entrance. The man would pull away at the moment of petit mort, and both would avoid the misadventure of an unplanned pregnancy. If a girl did fall pregnant, she would be married off to an older man with a headring, not her young lover. These youngsters scorned the advances of the middle-aged men of the Ndlondlo, making matters worse. There were far more women of the Ngunge. And historian John Labunt, in his book Rope of Sand, quotes one line from a girl who said, "The necklace is not long enough to fit around the neck." A pseudonym, if there ever was one. Sensing danger, Cetshwayo hastily announced that another Amabuto, the younger Ihloko, would gain their headrings. The women were even more angry after this because they asked, why did this Amabuto get headrings when their lovers from the Mbonambi and the Ududu regiments did not? A fair question. Cetshwayo had got himself in a social jam. He could not allow this breakdown of royal control, which had been instituted so successfully by Shaka. Controlling men's access to creating their lineage through legalizing sex was his magic, and the Ndlondlo were fobbing him off. Beware the Zulu king scorned. Furious, he dispatched warriors from the Imthiyo, Sakhu, and Ngoma Khosi Ubuto to scour the land and kill any Ngunge woman who had not married the Ndlondlo and Ihloko and seize the property of their fathers. A few besotted couples fled to Natal and the protection of the British, but most had to end their relationships as the women hastily married the older men as ordered by the king. Cetshwayo then decreed that any young couples found travelling alone in Zululand should be killed. Their bodies would be placed across the path they had been taking, facing each other. A chilling warning. It is hard to say how many died, but later chiefs admitted killing dozens of girls and their lovers. Mshaya Mkomo of the Ingobamakosi said he had killed 33 women and had three couples laid face to face on their final journey. However, AmaZulu sympathies lay with the king, feeling that the elder men had been cheated of their rights by the young women. It was brought to Cetshwayo's attention, however, that some of the territorial chiefs were not enforcing his rule, particularly in the Nkandla district along the middle Tugela River. Siganana Kazokufa of the Xube was particularly problematic, Shaka had never succeeded in defeating him, if you remember the stories of the clan who took shelter on the hilltops. This rankled Cetshwayo and boded ill for future events. Speaking of events, there would be another even more threatening. When Cetshwayo gathered the thousands of Amabutu warriors on the Mahlabatini Plain for the Umkhosi ceremonies in December 1877, the various warriors were tightly barracked together for the festival. The king's councillors were going to make a big mistake. Because of space restrictions, 16 Amakanda or homesteads clustered around Mahlabatini were hosting these warriors, and in one, Cetshwayo crammed the boastful young Ngobamakosi alongside the older warriors. The tradition had been to barrack the younger Amabutu along the Mbalani stream, not inside the huts with the much-respected older men. So protocol was not being observed, but it was made infinitely worse by the attitude of the Ngobamakosi, who apparently were boastful, showing little respect. The married men were visited by their wives. They forced the younger Ngobamakosi to wait outside the huts while they made merry. Some of these women had taken lovers from the younger Ngobamakosi before they had married, and here they were being made love to under the very noses of their young beaus. It was Christmas Day, 25th December 1877, when the chafing turned into trouble. Two Amabutu formed up at the gate of Undini to proceed to the Mkhosi ceremony for the day, and then a stick fight broke out. The Indlu Yangwe, one of the youngest Ubutu, who had been joined with the aging Itulwana to bring them up to strength, began to fight. The youngsters succeeded in driving the elders back into their huts. This was the ultimate humiliation. The elders grabbed their spears and counterattacked. The youngsters had very little chance. They were only armed with fighting sticks. Quarrels of this sort were supposed to be sorted out without resorting to deadly weapons. Cetshwayo up on the hill could see what was going on. He sent messengers to order the men to stop fighting, but their blood was up. The Itulwana pursued the Ngobamakosi across one of the tributaries of the Watamfolosi, the Ntukwini, right into the middle of the king's massive herd of cattle. These stampeded in fright and disappeared into the hills. The Ngobamakosi managed to rally, but the fighting went on all day, tailing off in the early evening. 70 men were dead. Cetshwayo booted out the Ngobamakosi and fined them a cow per person. Now AmaZulu public opinion swung against Cetshwayo. He'd bungled by breaking the rules. He had a soft spot for the Ngobamakosi, and this had befuddled his decision-making. Utulwana Induna Hamu was beside himself with rage, suffering from a severe beating at the hands of the Ngobamakosi. He demanded that the Induna Sikwele Kwele Kai Mhleke Hleke be put to death. The king refused. Sikwele Kwele was a favourite. He would only pay a fine. Hamu stomped off to Kwamfemfe, his home in the north, and he would only return on the eve of the invasion of Zululand by the British. Cetshwayo already had his eyes on the north, where the Transvaal Republic Boers claimed land in the Utrecht district, and these unresolved territorial disputes were going to become critical. We'll return to events in Zululand next episode, but right now our attention swings back to Cape Town. Already scarred by the Ninth Frontier War, which you heard about last episode, Governor Sir Bartle Frere must have been feeling his age. He was 62 when he arrived in South Africa in March 1877, and in the late 19th century, that was old. The average life expectancy for men in England was 44, and if males survived past that age, they could live only to 70. The average life expectancy for males in England today is 82 by comparison. Frere appeared to be rushing decisions. He was close friends with David Livingstone the missionary, as well as shipping magnate William MacKinnon. Frere and MacKinnon attended King Leopold of Belgium's Brussels Geographical Conference of 1876 as members of the British delegation. From this emerged the International African Association. The conference was a gathering of European explorers, philanthropists, and Geographic Society members to promote a humanitarian mission in Central Africa, though it served as a front for Leopold's private colonial ambitions. Leopold was the president of the International African Association, which was to coordinate European nations in following up the explorers' work on the continent. They spun the whole narrative, talking in grandiose ways about civilizing the dark continent, while the reality was they were intent on seizing land and commodities, not to mention creating new markets for their exports. While the Europeans began to elbow each other out of the way as they took aim at Africa, Freer's talented daughter Mary joined him in Cape Town, and her letters are illuminating. She began sounding the alarm about her father and his inability to cope with the chaos of South Africa.
"The whole country is disorganized," she wrote in 1877.
A year later, her missives became darker.
"He is very worn with the last 18 months' work and is bent as ever on knocking nails into his coffin."
Incredibly, events in Afghanistan were going to contribute to the cause of the Anglo-Zulu War. The key issue was Freer's view on Britain's political relations with Afghanistan, which commanded a great deal of respect in official circles and with the English general public. Masterly inactivity was to be avoided. It was all action, firm action, he said, and others like him were saying the same, to stop Russian advances in Central Asia. Intelligence officers should be sent to Afghanistan to curry favour with the Emir of Afghanistan. The country could even be annexed. And here, in his letter to Sir John Kaye in 1874, we find a most important paragraph.
"If the frontier commander is ambitious, his uncivilized neighbors give him constant and apparently justifiable cause for hostilities, which, in the end, must always lead to the victorious advance of the stronger and more civilized power."
All of this became known when the Times newspaper printed Freer's letter to Sir John Kaye in 1878. While the story was published because the Colonial Office was obsessed with Afghanistan, we can understand his views as a precursor to how Freer was going to manipulate and pressurize Cetshwayo Khampande in the direction of an imperial war. Nothing happens in isolation in history. We must always stand back and view planet Earth as an organic whole. In Afghanistan's case, the British had manipulated and pressurized the Emir Sher Ali Khan. They wanted to counter the Russian presence in Kabul, and a British mission was sent to Afghanistan, but was refused entry by the Emir. London sent the Emir an ultimatum to apologize and agree to a British mission. The Emir's answer came late and was unsatisfactory. So three columns of British troops invaded Afghanistan in November 1878. The sequence of events on which Freer had some influence convinced Freer that this was an ideal blueprint for his own handling of the Zulu situation. England was going to invade Zululand almost exactly a year after invading Afghanistan. And here is an important fact. Between 1815 and 1914, the British waged more colonial wars than any other European power, except their old enemy, France. Freer was hoping that all the cards were stacked in his favour. There was one big thorn in his side. The boundary commissioners, who had sat on a territorial dispute between the Zulu and the Transvaal Boers, had settled in the main in favour of Zulu claims against the Boers. But Britain had annexed the Transvaal, and now there was drama unfolding on the border with Zululand, at least in the minds of the Natal residents and expansionists in Freer's administration. Bishop Colenso and his daughter Frances Colenso watched with growing alarm as the quite obvious distortions about Cetshwayo metastasized. The Zulus and the colonists had lived in peace for 20 years before this war. Why stoke the fires now, they asked. Reports of Cetshwayo's harsh penalty against couples seeking to flee Zululand didn't help matters. The Ides were not idling. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm loading updates about a whole bunch of episodes, and I'm going to send out a newsletter shortly. You can email me from there too. Until next, Salagatli.